Welcome back for the second half hour of Issues Etc. We're going to be talking with Jennifer Lawl here for just a few minutes on two issues: the use of embryonic mice stem cells to reverse the paralysis in a rat. It's a story from ABC News. We'll play it for you, then we'll be talking with Jennifer about that. Also, we'll take up the subject of pre-screening, embryonic testing, testing human embryos for diseases that they may contract later in life. Jennifer Lawl will join us here in just a few minutes. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for June is called Reasonable Ethics. It actually dovetails quite nicely with some of these ethical issues we're discussing here in this half hour. It's a Christian approach to social, economic, and political concerns. For more information about the book, just go to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Look for our book of the month for June called Reasonable Ethics, or you can call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours and ask for the book, Reasonable Ethics, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. It's the Issues Etc. book of the month for June. First, let's hear more about the story. The story is a rat is paralyzed by a virus. And in the lab, they're able to extract embryonic stem cells from mice with some miraculous results. At least that's what they're saying. Here's more from ABC News and Charlie Gibson.
One of the great hopes for stem cells has been the prospect that they might be used to reverse paralysis. Well, now there is evidence they can. The news involves lab animals, just rats so far, but it's research that may hold out real hope for humans. Here's ABC's Ned Potter.
It has been a long-sought and elusive goal. This rat was paralyzed in the hind legs by a virus. In a few months, it was able to move again. Researchers injected their rats with stem cells, plus a mix of chemicals to help the cells grow into nerve tissue. In 11 out of 15 tries, it worked.
I think that even 2-3 years ago, the possibility of this was really more in the realm of science fiction.
There have been other experiments with paralyzed animals, but this is the first in which stem cells actually created new, healthy nerves known as motor neurons.
This is important in spinal cord injury, in diseases like ALS. Polio would be an example where the actual connection to the muscle was lost, and now we have a possibility that that might be replaceable.
But the stem cells came from mouse embryos, which had to be destroyed when they were removed. So the moral debate over stem cell research continues. Some advocates say there is no need to destroy embryos. Usable stem cells can come from the adult body or from the umbilical cords of newborns.
There's a lot of science yet to be done to say whether embryonic will ever be any good to treat a patient.
The Johns Hopkins researchers, meanwhile, say their experiment is proof, in this case at least, that stem cells can actually heal. Ned Potter, ABC News, New York.
All right, there's the story from the news. Jennifer Lawl joins us. She's founder and national director for the Center for Bioethics and Culture. She's a regular guest. Jennifer, welcome back.
Thanks. Hi, how are you?
I'm doing very well. How about you?
Well, other than my blood is boiling from listening to that clip, I'm well.
All right, what makes your blood boil listening to that news story?
Well, first you hear, now there is evidence, and we dug up three-month-old news. Now, that's old for news. March 11th, 2006, we have the video clip on our homepage on our website of the walking mouse that was paralyzed and treated at the University of Louisville with adult stem cells. So it makes me crazy when I hear this new embryonic stem cell cure coming out that's now finally able to cure paralyzed rats, when this is not new news.
So the earlier news actually involved adult stem cells, wherein no embryos needed to be destroyed for this mouse to walk again.
Absolutely. Adult human stem cells taken from, get this, from inside the nose. You know, what a non-invasive procedure to be able to go up your nose and just get some scrapings of stem cells and treat a paralyzed rat. I mean, you should watch this little video. It's cool. I mean, it shows the rat paralyzed going across the tightrope, falls off, and then the rat that has the same paralyzed leg is treated with adult stem cells from inside a human nose and now walks across this little tight rope. This is March 11, 2006, the University of Louisville.
All right, Jennifer, here's where that news story, and I think it was kind of implied in there, but also the general debate seems to go, and that is it's kind of who gets there first. It's more about, it doesn't seem to be about which form of embryonic or which form of stem cells can do better, even if they could take embryonic stem cells and cure every disease they've promised to cure. Would that override the moral and ethical concerns regarding them?
Well, no, it would never override the moral and ethical concerns for people who have moral and ethical concerns. I mean, obviously, for the people who don't share these moral and ethical concerns, you know, really it is a race to get there first and to get there in any way, in all ways, in as many ways as one can get there without being mindful of, you know, fiscal responsibility or transparency and accountability issues or moral and ethical things. So, and it's, you know, anything that's done in the embryo stem cell arena, even the best pro-embryo stem cell researchers will tell you it is still a long ways before we will get this into, you know, human trial level research. Because of the embryo research, the embryonic stem cell research still has a high propensity to tumor formation, which is why I am still watching the University of Louisville adult stem cell paralyzed rat treatments for, you know, long-term treatments for people, because adult stem cells don't have the problem with tumor formation.
Okay, I know it makes your blood boil to find that the old news that you have been talking about regarding adult stem cells goes largely ignored. Why do you think it goes largely ignored?
Well, I mean, news, you know, circulates around controversy and, you know, causing division. And if you can say this is a Republican versus a Democrat, if this is a religious versus secular, you know, if you can cause a big, huge mud fight, you know, that just sells. You know, sexy news sells better than boring, oh, isn't this wonderful, we all agree. And, you know, we have known all along that science has changed and does not like to be told this is not okay, this is not allowable. You know, science wants to be given our money to just do whatever they want with it, and they don't want us to tell them what they can and can't do. It's controversial, and it just flies in their face.
Well, we have we are really in some very crucial stages here in the state of Missouri.
Oh, you bet.
About embryonic stem cells, although the word embryonic is assiduously avoided.
Sure.
In most of the ads for the Missouri Coalition for Life-Saving Cures, they're not only had put out ads in order to get the 250,000 signatures that they needed for a ballot initiative, but they've managed to get that, and now they have been distributing flyers. I saw one just earlier this week. In kind of a voter's guide, encouraging the voters when they go to the polls in November to vote yes on their embryonic stem cell initiative. They call it a total ban on human cloning, and it's sold largely on the promises about what embryonic stem cells can do. What do we know so far?
Well, we know that so far they don't do a whole heck of a lot when you compare them, especially side-by-side adult stem cell therapies. And there are real-life people today who are walking around who have been treated successfully with adult stem cells. An adult stem cell includes umbilical cord blood. You know, there is nobody in the world who has benefited from a therapy or a treatment from embryo stem cells. I do think it's unfortunate, too, in Missouri that people are not being told the truth that it is cloning. The research that the Missourians are being asked to vote on does allow for human cloning. What it doesn't allow for is that cloned embryo to be implanted and people to start creating cloned children. But it, in fact, does create a human cloned embryo for destruction for research.
What do you make of Don Rubin, who's the president of the Missouri Coalition for Life-Saving Cures? We interviewed him on the program, and he commented near the end of the conversation that, look, if you're one of those people who has serious moral qualms about embryonic stem cell research, fine and good. But, you know, have your qualms. We're not going to argue with you. But don't deny the potential cures that are out there from embryonic stem cell research to the rest of Missourians.
Well, to that I would say, then let's tell the state of Missouri the whole truth and nothing but the truth, And then let, truly, as in a democracy, let the voters decide. Let's not tell them what we want them to know or what they think they should know, but let's tell them the honest-to-goodness, you know, rock-solid facts. And then I do think that people will make, you know, well-informed decisions when they go into the voting booth. I'm in the state of California. We asked our poor voters out here to slog through a 10,000-word initiative, you know, that was titled, and this is my editorial, "We'll cure everybody in the whole world if you vote yes." You know, people see the sound bites. You know, they see the images of people with handicapped children and people walking in, you know, with walkers, and it tugs on their heart. But let's tell them the truth.
We're talking with Jennifer Lull. She's founder and national director of the Center for Bioethics and Culture, about the use of stem cells to reverse paralysis in mice and rats. In a few minutes, we'll turn to the subject of embryonic testing, pre-screening embryos for diseases they may later have in life. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. So the bottom line on the news that people may have seen on ABC News about this rat, and it's remarkable to see this rat pulling itself along on 2 feet, and then after the magic of the laboratory, walking on all fours. What's the bottom line they should understand about this, Jennifer?
Well, the bottom line is as my good friend and colleague said today, this is good news for rats. You know, but where is the treatment that these scientists are proposing that are going to help people, and all people? And in my book, you know, the embryo is a people too. And, you know, woe be it for us to start using some people at the benefit of others, which I think will segue nicely into your, you know, pre-testing embryos in advance, because we just want, you know, good, healthy people, whether they be alive or whether they be unborn, whatever. You know, our tolerance level for, you know, sickness or disabilities or anything less than perfect, by whose standard I'm not yet sure, our tolerance for that is waning.
Jennifer, let's turn to that subject of pre-testing embryos for genetic diseases. Here's a Reuters story to bring everybody up to speed.
A new method of embryo screening using DNA fingerprinting could give hope to couples at risk of passing on genetic diseases to their children. Instead of searching for an altered gene linked to an inherited illness, the new test looks for DNA fingerprints or markers near the gene. Presently, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis can test for around 200 inherited conditions in embryos produced during in vitro fertilization. The new method allows thousands to be identified. The discovery has rekindled an ethics debate on embryo selection.
This will prevent parents from having to make the very difficult decision to terminate a pregnancy if a baby is affected by a non-life-threatening condition. Obviously, if you can choose a baby or an embryo that's not going to be affected by a disease, then it would be preferable to have the embryo that didn't have that condition.
We should be using the new genetics, all the new information we have, which is very exciting, to find better ways to cure those patients and those carriers of these genetic diseases. This is simply a search and destroy mechanism. It's got nothing whatsoever to do with curing disease.
Some worry that technological advances will lead to designer babies being created for parents who want to control everything from eye colour to musical aptitude. Michelle Kalal Al-Houri, Reuters.
All right, there's the story, Jennifer. What exactly are those who are in favor of embryonic pre-testing or pre-screening, what are they talking about here?
Well, they're talking about something we call eugenics. I love the gentleman who said, baby, oops, embryo. I mean, talk about a Freudian slip. You know, don't you dare call an embryo a baby, because then you can't be cloning them and destroying them for research once you've called them babies. But, yeah, it's just, you know, like I heard the one woman who called it the search and destroy. You know, we don't want handicapped babies. We don't want less than perfect children. I mean, this is already alive and well in the United States. Last week I saw an article, you know, talking about people from other countries are coming to the U.S. because we have no regulation, and they're coming here so that they can pretest embryos and get the sex that they want. I mean, I said earlier, our tolerance is waning. Our tolerance is, you know, at zero. you know, to the point where we are going to pre-screen embryos to get the sex of the child we want, let alone the child that might be, you know, have an inheritable or genetic disease or have Down syndrome. You know, out here in California where it's, you know, we're very environmentally conscious and people have the save the spotted owl. I say save the Down syndrome child. You know, that's going to be my car bumper sticker because we're one generation away from, you know, no more children with Down syndrome are going to be born. Is that good news? That's not good news for me. I think that's appalling.
So the problem is not with the screening itself, but the impulse behind it and how that information will inevitably be used.
Right. It's a business. You know, we are picking and choosing the kind of children we want. We are designing our children. You know, we're willing to pay top dollar, big money, you know, to get the child that you know we want.
Are there circumstances, Jennifer, under which you would advise a couple who is pregnant to pre-screen?
No. I mean, I think there's clearly times when couples who know that they have a genetic disease or they have a family history, you know, meet with genetic counselors. They may choose not to have children because the risk might be high for certain types of diseases. But I draw the line that an embryo, you know, from conception till natural death is human life, and I don't believe that any time along that continuum we can decide that this life is not valuable and this life is unfit or this life is not worth living.
What about someone who simply wants the information but has no intent or plan to use that information to terminate the embryo?
Well, I think there's a lot to be said to, you know, the response that I have is information is not knowledge. Information is not wisdom. I know a lot of people have been given information. They've been told, you are at high risk for, you have the genetic propensity for. And these people sometimes that I have met live their life on hold. They live their life waiting for the shoe to drop. Every time they can't find their car keys, they go, there's that Alzheimer's they told me I'm at risk for. You know, and it's, you know, when there's no treatment or there's no therapy, to address this information, what are we going to do with it? Are we going to tell our boss who might say, you know what, I'm going to terminate you when budget gets tight because you're at risk for a disease? I mean, there's just so many problems around having this information and who has access to it and what do we do with it.
I was talking with a producer the other day, and we were talking about in the context of the church, and I had just said something like, well, the church really missed the boat when it came to in vitro fertilization. We did not, at least from my end of it, we did not see the problems that would arise from in vitro fertilization. We were very naive about what it meant.
Right.
And nowadays, and I think that could be said of a lot of different sectors of the pro-life community who look out and say, I wish we would have seen what was coming with in vitro fertilization and afterwards, things like selecting the embryo you want and simply eliminating the others or freezing the others or trying to get stem cells out of those that are frozen, things like that.
Absolutely. I think we were playing a very short game, and we thought, oh, we found a way to have our couples in our congregations have babies. Isn't this grand? And then, you know, less than a generation away, we have all these kids walking the face of the earth wanting to know who their sperm donor dad is, who their, you know, egg donor mother is. We've got couples that go, oh, my gosh, I have five children frozen in the fertility bank. I never thought of them as children. You know, we have embryo adoption clinics popping up across the nation to deal with the almost 500,000 frozen embryos out there. And we weren't very long-sighted when we just jumped on this bandwagon and said, yay, we can have babies.
Was that at least just the very narrowest point of the wedge for what we're seeing now with people, normally fertile couples, saying, now, if we can manage the front end of this conception thing, why can't we manage it all the way through and get the child we really want? I mean, if someone just wants a child, then they go to in vitro fertilization. But if we want the child we really want, then we can have embryonic pretesting.
Well, I don't know if I'd call it the wedge, but it was obviously a tipping point. you know, there was a lot of things that were happening in the, you know, the 70s, first test tube baby, Louise Brown, birth control, sex revolution, you know, that just sort of set this ball into motion. And now we have the human embryonic cloning stem cell debate before us, designer baby. You know, we at the same time we got all this information about the genetic makeup of the human genome. So there's a lot of things are coming together. And, you know, for me, my work is trying to focus on connecting all these dots and making people see the consequences and to see down the road a bit more, so that we don't create another kind of, problem on our hand 10 years down the road, and that I can leave the, you know, the culture when I'm old and gray to my children in a little bit better shape is my hope.
So what's the bottom line here? We talked about the bottom line for the news that people heard about the reverse of paralysis in mice using embryonic stem cells. What's the bottom line for the news that they're hearing about embryonic testing?
Well, I think the bottom line is this is just the same old story that's, you know, that's facing the human race since the beginning of time. You know, we are always prone to want to improve upon nature or creation. We saw that with the Tower of Babel. You know, we always think we can figure it out. And I'm not saying that we're not supposed to figure it out, but we're supposed to figure it out and work hard at understanding and discovering with a moral compass.
Jennifer,
and
go
that's
ahead.
That's just what's missing here.
Jennifer Lowell is National Director for the Center for Bioethics and Culture. Jennifer, thank you very much for your time. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, Todd.
TheCBC.org is the website address for the Center for Bioethics and Culture. TheCBC, it's all one word, .org. Monday on the program, by the way, we're going to be talking about the Missouri Stem Cell Initiative with Dr. Richard Cole of Washington University. When we come back from this break, we've got audio open lines for your questions and your comments. People often wonder, what is audio open lines? We heard Wilkin talking about audio open lines. It's just like ordinary open lines, except we let someone else do the talking. We have other issues that we lay on the table. We play audio sound bites, like coming up here in this bit of audio open lines. We'll be hearing from Bishop Gene Robinson, the first openly gay bishop in the Episcopal Church USA, reacting to, he thinks things haven't turned out so well at this general convention of the Episcopal Church USA, sounding kind of snippy. And then we'll have an interview with the presiding bishop, the new presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church. That would be Shorey, and she's going to have some interesting things to say as well. She has a much rosier picture of how things are going to turn out. What we do is we play that audio, and then we want to hear from you, your reaction to it, the subjects raised by it. Might have a question or two, or maybe you do. It's regular open lines, and as usual, always anything you want to talk about. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Even though we say open lines, we also have an open email address here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Use the numbers, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727, or that email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org, to join us in the next hour for audio open lines, and then we'll play soundbite of the week in the last half hour. Stay tuned. Open Lines is next.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
What makes this such a unique place is that the Word of God is so central and is proclaimed with such vigor and such clarity at this place.
Dr. Larry Rast on the uniqueness of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Here the scriptures are at the center. The Lutheran confessions as a right exposition of the scriptures are held up for all the world to hear. Here we are concerned about our historical past and being faithful to the proclamation of the gospel as the scriptures give them to us and as the faithful church has delivered those over time. And also we are concerned about preparing servants for the church, pastors who will preach the word and administer the sacrament. So what you have is a community with Christ at the center of all things. And as such, that truly makes this a unique place.
Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. The National Education Association is getting ready for its annual convention next week. Every year, the union pushes its liberal agenda a bit further. But this year, conference delegates could be voting on supporting gay marriage and increasing the union's liberal clout. Bob Kellogg reports those that oppose the measures are few but passionate.
For years, the union's diversity policy has included the whole homosexual alphabet soup. Southern California teacher Geralee Smith says this year her union is wading even deeper into dangerous cultural waters.
This year, the National Education Association is asking the members to vote on an amendment saying that all of these diverse groups deserve same-sex marriage.
The NEA also has a goal of getting 75% of its members to vote the Liberal Union platform in the next elections. Smith says both measures, if proposed, will almost certainly pass.
This is a very huge organization, and we are very outnumbered. But we feel, the group of us that are there, feel committed to stand up and express the other side of the issues.
Focus on the Family Action Education analyst, Candy Cushman, says the resolutions will follow member teachers into the classroom.
Yes, they will be, because if the NEA is pouring thousands of union fee money into pushing these policies, then schools will be forced to follow these policies.
Meaning textbooks, lesson plans, and school activities will be laced with propaganda for gay marriage.
I think that all of this is a good reason for especially Christian teachers to rethink their membership in the NEA.
She says the current proposals could be the tipping point for those fighting the union from within. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Kellogg.
Many states allow teachers to be exempt from paying NEA dues if they are classified as religious objectors. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Get your tickets now for the 16th annual Christian Family Day at Busch Stadium. The Cards take on the Dodgers July 15th at 12:20 p.m. Tickets start at $29. And when you purchase your ticket through ChristianFamilyDay.com, that ensures that a child in St. Louis also gets to see the game and stick around for the Christian Family Day events after the game, including Albert Pujols and other players sharing their Christian testimonies. Visit ChristianFamilyDay.com.
Reasonable Ethics, A Christian Approach to Social, Economic, and Political Concerns is the title of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about Reasonable Ethics on our website, issuesetc.org. Reasonable Ethics by Dr. Robert Benny, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June.
Do they mean to stay with us? And by the way, were those extremists in our church who were threatening to leave, now are they going to stay and work for reconciliation, or do they mean to leave anyway?
All right, that's openly gay Bishop Gene Robinson. See, getting a little bit snippy on the occasion of the Episcopal Church USA's General Convention in Columbus, Ohio. He wants to know if the fellow Anglicans, I guess they call themselves Episcopalians, want to remain in the controversy and in conversation on the gay issues that are beleaguering that church. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's Audio Open Lines. We're going to hear a little bit more from Gene Robinson. Why isn't he happy? That's what I want to know. He was consecrated, the first openly gay bishop. He now has a presiding, well, he did before, Frank Griswold, the former presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church USA, very happily consecrated him. Who's opposed him? A few who've decided to leave, some who are still unhappy, a few reform groups. Sounds like he's getting his way. Now he has a presiding bishop in Kathleen Jefford-Shorey, who says she's even more in favor of this than anyone else. So I don't know what he's worried about. In Columbus, Ohio, according to the AP, in a reluctant effort to salvage Anglican unity, Episcopalians have passed a non-binding resolution urging the Episcopal leaders to, quote, exercise restraint when considering gay candidates for bishop. Maybe that's what has Gene Robinson upset. He doesn't want any exercise of restraint. Well, maybe he knows that had they exercised restraint 2 years ago, he wouldn't be bishop. The measure stops far short, by the way, of the moratorium that was asked for by the Anglican Communion on the gay bishop issue. There was some outrage, of course, among the 77 million members of the Anglican Communion when in 2003 they consecrated Gene Robinson as the new bishop in New Hampshire. But it may leave open the chance for discussion between the leaders of the Episcopal Church and the other members of the Anglican Communion who hold that the Bible prohibits gay sex. What a radical idea. What an amazing idea to propose in the church in this day and age that the Bible actually prohibits homosexuality. Well, let's get some more reaction from Bishop Gene Robinson to yesterday's vote to exercise some restraint when it comes to gay ordinations in the Episcopal Church USA.
We're in this for the long haul. We're not going anywhere. We have never threatened to leave this church, and we're not threatening to do so now.
Baby boomers. They never leave. They stay until whatever it is they've decided to stay in is completely destroyed, but they don't leave. People of principle, these Anglicans, they call themselves continuing Anglicans, who have been outraged at the ordination of an openly gay man to be bishop in their church, they've sometimes had no other choice but to leave. But it sounds as though, according to Gene Robinson, if it comes down to that, they'll be the last ones left in the church. They really don't care who leaves. They're going to stay. Boomers. They never leave institutions. They stay and destroy them, if need be. Well, look at the... Don't look at me. The Episcopal Church USA has its own numbers to answer for. Those of you who measure the success or the wisdom of any venture by how many numbers it can garner, don't look at me. The Episcopal Church USA is down 40%. In 30 years. The Presbyterian Church USA debating the same issue and heading the same direction, one half in the last half decade of their membership, G-O-N-E, gone. And they're scratching their head saying, maybe we need to ordain more lesbians and gays. That's the problem. It's sad, but it's also fascinating in a macabre kind of way to watch these churches self-destruct, all the while claiming victory. Finally, here again is Bishop Gene Robinson. He says that presiding bishop-elect Catherine Jefferts Shorey reluctantly supported the resolution in a bid simply to salvage the unity of the Anglican Communion.
She stands for the full inclusion of gay and lesbian people in our church. I believe her 100%. I think this is a very painful thing for her to do.
So she's humoring the Anglican Communion. She wants there to be gay bishops, more of them. Gene Robinson's the first, but perhaps there will be more. Gay pastors, gay marriages, that's what full inclusion means. It's code for full inclusion of homosexuals in the pastoral ministry and at the altar for weddings. And she simply supported this exercise of restraint on the part of the Episcopal Church USA because she wants to salvage some unity. What kind of unity can there be between members of a church body who say the Bible prohibits this and other members who say we don't care? Doesn't sound like any kind of unity I'm familiar with. Our call-in numbers, it's audio open lines 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. I'd like to hear your reaction to what Gene Robinson has been saying lately since I guess he figures that things didn't quite go his way. What did he want the Episcopal Church to do? To tell the Anglican Communion when they say, please exercise restraint on exercise. They didn't say, don't ordain gay bishops. They just said, please exercise some restraint. And they said, we will. What did he want them to do? Did he want them to tell the rest of the 77 million Anglicans in the world to go jump in a lake? I want your reaction to Gene Robinson. This is something else he had to say.
Do they mean to stay with us? And by the way, were those extremists in our church who are threatening to leave, now are they going to stay and work for reconciliation, or do they mean to leave anyway?
Does he want them to stay? Or does he want them to leave? He calls them extremists. Think about that. We have come to the place where in a mainline Protestant denomination in the United States, those who think that homosexuality is wrong and that we probably shouldn't have gay pastors are now the extremists. The man, by the way, who calls for the full inclusion of gays, gay marriage, homosexual ordination, he's not an extremist. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org, and it's audio open lines. This would all just be interesting parlor conversation if I were not so firmly convinced that what we are watching here are simply the first in the Presbyterian Church USA, the Episcopal Church USA. They're following closely upon the heels of the United Church of Christ, a little bit behind them, the United Methodist Church and a couple other denominations, all headed the same direction. And it's not just on the issue of homosexuality. This is only the latest symptom of their abandonment of God's word. I would ask the question, what's next? What do you think is next? After Gene Robinson gets what he wants, and he will eventually. I mean, the last time the Episcopal Church USA promised that they would not do something, in the voice of their bishop, Frank Griswold, at Lambeth, where they said, let's not ordain any gay bishops, Frank Griswold flew back to the United States and within the course of about 2 months was ordaining the first gay bishop. So the fact that they promised to exercise restraint just doesn't really mean anything at all. But if he has gay bishops, let's say every bishop in the Episcopal Church USA is eventually either a gay or a lesbian. What's next? Anybody? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. For those of you who thought it'd never get this far, you know, there were a lot who said, look, we can ordain women, and then we can stop. We can disregard Paul on the issue of whether or not women should occupy the pastoral office, and then we'll stop. Kind of like the alcoholic who says, okay, I know I'm an alcoholic, but I'm just going to have one drink, and then I'll stop. Well, they haven't stopped. Roy calls from his car. Roy, welcome to Audio Open Lines.
Hi, Pastor Wilkin. As you know, from a fellow Texan, I was an Episcopalian for many, many years, and, of course, was one in southern Texas, which was very Orthodox and very conservative. And I'll never forget when I moved to St. Louis, the pastor priest that I had warned me about the Diocese of Missouri and to be careful on what church I chose. I didn't really know what he was talking about at the time and, of course, realized what was to come. But the slippery slope, you just touched on it, was the ordination of women over 30 years ago. And if you draw a line on the loss of members with that move that they made, you're going to see what happened. And that was just the start. And then the cultural nature of the, I would call them elitist Episcopalians, like the former bishop here in this diocese, that was more of a social gospel preacher than the gospel preacher. And we know, I mean, Paul warned us that we will accept the truth for lies and the lies for truth, and it's very evident in what's going on in this communion.
Roy, what do you think's next?
Oh, I think it's just going to be more of the same. I think they're going to, it's going to be a little bit like what happened at Concordia a long time ago. I think you're going to have the liberal elitist have their own little cubbyhole, and they're going to be by themselves. And one of these days, I think you're seeing some of the more Orthodox people leave, but there's a lot of pastors, including my former one, that's got a lot vested in his retirement plans and all sorts of things in his parish that's very Orthodox. And so he's kind of stuck in a hard place, those that still believe the scriptures.
Roy, thank you very much for the call. We were talking yesterday with Parker Williamson about the state of affairs in the Presbyterian Church USA, and he said something very similar to what Roy just said. You know, there are Presbyterian pastors and congregations watching in the Presbyterian Church USA exactly the same kind of things happen. They're a step or two behind the Episcopalian Church, okay? But some of these pastors are simply hunkering down. They're saying, okay, we're just going to raise the drawbridge and pull in all the chains, close the walls off, and our congregation will continue to be a faithful congregation. I'll continue to be a faithful pastor, and we are just not going to let what's happening outside our little congregation bug us. And others are saying, we can't but notice what's happening outside the walls of our little congregation. And they're leaving. Neither of those are really good solutions, are they? Well, picking up on this subject, the newly elected presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church USA, Catherine Jeffords Shorey, granted an interview to Religion and Ethics News weekly correspondent just a couple days ago. Very interesting interview. Listen carefully to some of her responses. We'll be stopping and starting here occasionally to get your reaction. It's audio open lines, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. If Gene Robinson is pessimistic about exercising restraint, I think it's fair to say that Catherine Jeffords Shorey sounds positively rosy about the future of her church.
You mentioned right away when, after your election, that you saw the church as having an opportunity to be a vehicle for the reign of God. And I just wanted you to tell us a little bit more about what you see. What is that vision of the church?
Well, the church is a community that is really called to transform the world around it. That takes different forms in different places. Each one of us has got a piece to play in that kind of work. And the fact that this General Convention has adopted justice and peace as its first priority for mission in the coming triennium, particularly focused on the UN Millennium Development Goals, gives us an enormous opportunity to be part of building something that looks very much like the reign of God, that's achievable in our own day.
Are you very mindful of the magnitude of what you're lurching into?
Probably not fully. I'm sure I will have much to learn that I don't even know about. But I think life is meant to be challenging. If we're going to use the fullness of the gifts that we've been given, it means we have to continue to be stretched. And I look forward to that.
What message does your election send to all the quarters of the Episcopal Church?
This is not your grandmother's church anymore. When I was growing up, girls and women could only do things like sing in the choir and serve on the altar guild, and singing's not my great strength, so I had no concept of being active in leadership in the church when I was growing up.
All right, now she said something there that every time it said just makes me giggle a little bit. She said, in answer to the question, what message does your election, leave the question there please, what message does your election send to all of the quarters of the Episcopal Church? You know, this is a divided church. Her response, this is not your grandmother's church anymore. Tell grandma to stay home on Sunday, by the way. Whenever you hear your pastor or anyone else in leadership in the church say something like that, this is not your grandmother's church or this is not your grandfather's church, you call grandma and grandpa first thing and tell them, pastor doesn't want you in church on Sunday. It's not your church anymore. What does it mean? What does a statement like that mean? This isn't your grandmother's church. Well, I think I know what Catherine Jeffords Shorey means by this. We're moving ahead. And look, all those people of the greatest generation, grandma and grandpa, who just couldn't get their head around a gay bishop and couldn't quite grasp, you know, they're stuck in their ways. They're backward. They represent the old people, the old generation, an old way of thinking, an old way of doing things. We're not for them anymore. We're moving on. Now, if they want to get hip like the rest of us, they could stick around. But we're moving on. And if you want to stick it out with grandma, you can stick it out, but we're leaving you behind. That's what it means. It is it is the mantra of the Christian liberal, and especially of those in the baby boom generation. Even though, oddly enough, a good portion of them are grandparents themselves, I wonder if they say that to their grandkids. Hey, Junior, this isn't your grandfather's church. Thanks, Grandpa. Get the heck out of here. What if their kids said that to them? Sorry, Grandpa. It ain't your church anymore. This isn't your grandmother's church. Would you say that to your grandmother? I wouldn't. Would you say that to your grandfather? If you're a grandfather or a grandmother, you drive by a church that has this out on their signpost. Some of them have been dumb enough to do it. Put this mantra out on their signpost. This isn't your grandmother's church. Well, if it were me, I might keep driving and go to brunch. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. What's your message that you want to send through your election? First female bishop to preside over the Episcopal Church USA. What's the message you think your election sends to all quarters of your church? Granny, stay home Sunday morning. It ain't your church anymore.
And what about for the rest of the communion? What message, what signal do you hope this sends to other members of the Anglican Communion?
I hope that our decisions at this General Convention send several messages to the rest of the communion, that we are incredibly anxious to continue to be part of the communion, that we are fully committed to partnerships across the globe, that we firmly believe that all people need to be included in the reign of God that is being built, that people of all colors and races and nations and language groups and sexual orientations are fully part of this creation that God has blessed us with.
What do you anticipate saying to some of the primates at your first meeting, including some that you know have problems with women and or women being ordained? What can you imagine yourself saying to them?
One would probably begin with hello, to begin to build some kind of a relationship. Speaking about each other's contexts, who am I, where do I come from, what kind of history do I bring, what kind of theology do I understand that this church is being called to, and we cannot have substantive conversations until we know each other as human beings.
Some people say that this has been a real crucial time for the Anglican Communion, just in terms of re-examining what Anglicanism means today in this world. Do you think that is going on right now?
Yes, it is, and I think it goes on in every age. Anglicanism has grown out of a history of struggle and tension. The great Elizabethan compromise that produced the Church of England was born out of incredible strife, but it has been a gift to many, many people around the globe.
And so in what way do you see, you know, what are some of the critical issues that global Anglicans need to be examining right now?
We need to be examining the poverty that is real around the world. We need to be examining the fact that our brothers and sisters, Anglican and not, in places like Africa and Asia, don't have enough to eat. Their children don't have the opportunity to go to school. AIDS and tuberculosis and malaria are rampant in many parts of this world, and people with those diseases don't have access to adequate health care. That's where our focus needs to be.
Clearly one of the big challenges, the big issue, is the sexuality debates. What message do you hope that this convention sends to people who are very upset about the consecration of Gene Robinson and are really opposed to blessing of same-sex unions? What signal do you hope they get from this convention?
That there is room for them at this table as well.
All right, now, that's the big question. This is the way it always begins. I don't know if, I think it's G.K. Chesterton or maybe one of those other old guys from a previous century who said, look, error always, always has the same modus operandi. Error begins by entering the room and asking, we don't want a place at the table. Just let us stand over here in the corner. You won't even notice us. We won't cause any trouble. We won't eat anything. Just let us stand in the corner. The next day, error says, now, we were here yesterday standing in the corner. Today, we would like to sit at the table. It would be nice. Just let us sit at the table. We don't have to sit at the head of the table. We'll sit down way at the other end. Then the next day, they say, now that we're at the table, we think we deserve a better place. Maybe at the head of the table. And then the next day, error, having begun so modestly, just asking to stand in the corner, now sits at the head of the table and demands that everyone else leave. Where is the Episcopal Church USA right now? Sitting at the head of the table. Error is sitting at the head of the table, but still saying the rest of you can stay. Tomorrow, we'll see. Here's Andrew calling from his car. Hi, Andrew.
Hello. I just, you know, I just had to call you when I heard her statement concerning races and genders. Then she put in sexual orientation there. But to me, that's almost like saying, you know, it doesn't matter what race or gender you are. We want to reach you, but it also doesn't matter if you are an adulterer or a homosexual or whatever kind of lifestyle you're living. And, yeah, we do want to reach all those people, but I'm not sure they all need to be put into the same category. It's like, you know, in the Acts chapter 2 when all the cultures started to speak in their own languages, there wasn't like this, you know, category for, you know, homosexuals speaking in their own languages. And I think this has implications for, you know, church leadership as well. So I think there's some confusion there.
I think there's a fair bit of confusion. I think it's intentional. Confusing categories, that is, race and gender, immutable traits, with behaviors like sexual orientation. That's just the basic confusion that's taking place there. And I think it's intentional. I think it's fair to say that she includes it in those categories, knowing full well that there's a difference between being a woman and being homosexual, or being black or being Chinese and being homosexual. She knows there's a difference, but she doesn't want to recognize that there's a difference. Are there churches today that are excluding minorities and women from attending? They're not welcoming women anymore? Is that what's happening someplace out there? I don't know of any. In fact, the last time I checked, there are more women in church on Sunday morning than there are men. John is Don in Junction City, Kansas, listening on the Internet. Hi, Don.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. You know, when error once creeps into church, it grows and grows until it reaches the point where paganism may move in and take over. Pretty soon they'll be worshiping the goddess Sophia. There seems to be no stop to it after it once gets a good foothold. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much, Don. In fact, if you're paying attention to what's happening in the Presbyterian Church USA as they meet in their General Assembly in Birmingham, Alabama, you might have been interested to note that they're toying around with different ways of describing the Trinity, they say, but these ways, alternate to Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, don't actually describe the Trinity. They're even talking about mother, daughter, womb, instead of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. No, paganism is not far away. Part and parcel of paganism is thinking of this goddess mother. It's certainly not just another way of thinking about Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. It's audio open lines. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. So far, Catherine Jeffords Shorey, newly elected presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church USA, says her church is not your grandmother's church anymore, but there's still room at the table for everyone. Maybe not grandma, but everyone else. We'll be right back with more audio open lines.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.